We talk a lot about what should happen, but how? The what doesn't matter without the how. That's what we're talking about today on the Freewheeling Podcast. Welcome to Freewheeling, the free-thinking podcast about moving forward faster. My name's Thomas Abelman, and each week I'll bring you fresh voices, new ideas, and unconventional thinking. So let's get started now with this week's edition of the Freewheeling Podcast. If there's a symbol for Britain's political leadership at the moment, it's the 16 acres of empty space where Drummond Street and Grafton Place used to stand. They were flattened to make way for a new HS2 station. But 16 years after the project started, there are no designs for the station, and no consensus as to where HS2 will go, or even what it's for. The desolation of Euston typifies the ministerial churn, funding pots, constantly shifting priorities, strategies that go nowhere, and projects with no strategies that have become Britain's governance model. If you think it's not good enough, you'd be right. But there are people trying to make it better. The Future Governance Forum was set up to deal with precisely these issues, and Grace Wild is Head of Policy and Programmes at the Future Governance Forum. Grace Wild, welcome to the Freewheeling Podcast.
Thank you very much.
So, what exactly is the Future Governance Forum?
So we are a relatively new think tank. We launched just over a year ago, and our emphasis is really on implementation of policy. So we often say we're about the how rather than the what. And what that means in practice is that we're not publishing big reports or running big programs on health or transport is a good example. Absolutely not a transport expert.
And the reason I wanted you on here is exactly because you're not an expert on transport and mobility, but the how feels at the moment so much more important almost than the what. I mean, there are so many fantastic people in transport policy. We know what needs to be done, but the how has been getting more and more challenging. And it's actually the reason why I created Freewheeling as a business, why I left Transport for London, because I just felt this sense that we've lost the ability to really focus on the how. Where did it come from? Whose idea was it? Why did it happen?
Good question. I think we were motivated probably by a very similar reason to you on Freewheeling. So a reaction to the way in which politics has become a process of talking about priorities and talking about things that politicians want to do, as opposed to actually seeing how it survives contact with reality and making those things happen. And so we were particularly interested in adding to and contributing to a very rich ecosystem of think tanks and thought leaders around the political space, but with a really specific focus on the how. So it's not just a page at the end of a report where we think a little bit about the implementation. It's really taking centre stage. So
I've been going to so many meetings in my previous professional life in which the how was dominated by tiny funding pots for incredibly small micro priorities, the constant challenge of rebriefing new ministers. And that's true of every single department. This is not a particular transport problem. Have you been able to kind of diagnose how we ended up in this space? Because I don't believe many people go into politics intending not to deliver. And yet we've seemed to have created processes, structures, governance that makes delivery really hard.
I mean, I think if anything, there is evidence that the people that are the most motivated by public service end up leaving first, because the realities of trying to get stuff done is often really disconcerting. So yeah, completely agree with that diagnosis. What we're really interested in at the minute is what this moment of mission-driven government could mean for transformation in how we think about the how. So in many ways, I think about mission-driven government as an antidote to new public management, which has a lot to answer for in terms of lots of the challenges that you've
diagnosed. What's new public management?
So new public management is all about kind of command and control, that the centre can kind of diagnose a problem and prescribe the answers, and that, you know, a very linear process of knock-ons will fold out from that. What's really critical about missions is they are not just a signal of talking about priorities. They're actually a different way of doing things and meeting the complexity of today's challenges by, on the one hand, shaping markets in line with social goals. So really being clear that economic growth has a direction, not just a trend. But secondly, reforming public services for the long term in a sustainable and preventative way. And crucially, the thing that excites me most about this as a new way of doing things is that being mission driven means doing all of this in really deep partnership with the whole of society. The Test and Learn programme from the Cabinet Office is a great example of mission driven government, of embracing a culture of test and learn, de-risking failure and acknowledging that failure will happen and that the purpose of that is to learn and improve.
So it's interesting that you describe missions in this way as a new paradigm for government, because I suspect an awful lot of people will look at the list of missions and they'll see something that looks a bit like Tony Blair's pledge card or Rishi's five priorities. List of five things that we want to achieve. We want to decarbonise, we want better economic growth, etc., etc. And you're saying, no, that's just an output, that's a presentation, but actually the missions are about an entirely different way of doing government. And you've described a bit about what that looks like. Does the government know it's a completely different way of doing government?
Yes, I believe they do. And I think there is a real comms challenge around this because of the short-term nature of politics and the need for connecting short-term stories of change with longer-term ambition. And we've done a bit of work on this around how you do that through storytelling. It's not enough to say, well, our long-term ambitions are laid out in these five missions and just give us a bit of time because it's a 10-year programme and we'll get there. You've got to be able to connect those five missions with the day-to-day stories of change. People have got to feel it in their pockets. They've got to be able to feel that actually the net zero mission, for instance, matters to them and their lives for various reasons, be that in terms of energy costs or air quality for their kids. And of course, we talked about this before the election, the Prime Minister's time on the missions is critical. They've got to be seen as a priority from the top. But the majority of the Prime Minister's time always has been and always will be consumed by crisis and international events, and that is just the reality of that role. And so there's got to be sufficient structures and buy-in across government. It's got to be a whole of government approach so that these missions are stick and they survive through those moments.
And is that happening at the moment? Is government being done differently, or is this what you're describing, an ambition that, you know, we're only 6 months into a 5-year term, an ambition for how it will be?
There have definitely been changes that we've observed, and you know, we definitely don't know all of them, so take this with a pinch of salt, of course. But you know, there have been some really good efforts to, for instance, set up the structure of the centre to embrace and facilitate partnership working. If you think of it as kind of concentric circles closest to the centre of government, we've got to see a breaking down of silos between departments. Zooming out further, you've got to see a kind of whole public sector approach, so that not just local and regional government, but the wider public sector workforce are engaged in these missions. And zooming out even further, civil society, business, trade unions involved in the development, the articulation of the missions. The Test and Learn programme announced by Pat McFadden in December is a really fantastic example of what we mean by mission-driven government in practice. It's that innovation from the ground up. It is, bringing together partners across different disciplines and expertise in a specific place in order to just get going, try some things and see what works. They've talked about secondment opportunities for that knowledge transfer into government. One thing I'd love to see is for it to work the other way as well, for civil servants to be given opportunities to get out of Whitehall and work in other organisations for 6-month periods and so on. It's worth saying this is new and it's countercultural, and it does go against the grain of lots of the ways of working that are well established. So 6 months isn't much time. There are of course things we'd like to see more of. The missions need to sit above departments. There's a risk if, for instance, the health mission becomes a different way of talking about the remit of health and social care department, and that's not really the point of missions. Missions are meant to galvanise activity across disciplines. All departments in some way will be contributing to the health mission, and creating that culture of shared accountability is really, really hard to do. The spending review will be really critical, and we'd love to see the spending review done in a way that is structured around the missions with a really clear kind of preventative pot of funding and so on.
I think it can be really hard to sort of visualise what this means and what's different. And at the start, I talked about what the situation has been like. And it's been short-term funding pots, you know, strategies that don't really go anywhere. You know, I mean, you can look on any government department and there's a whole load of strategy documents that have been written in the last decade, which are written by incredibly capable and intelligent civil servants and basically might as well have not been written because nothing happened as a result of them. Describe to me what it will look like at the end. I don't know whether that's in 1 year or 5 years or 50 years, but describe to me what it will look like when this is absolutely how it all happens. And then, I'll give you a spoiler, my next question will be, what of that is already in place? How far along the journey from that place that we were in to the vision you're about to paint for us are we? But let's start with, what does it look like when it's all literally perfect and this is how it works?
What I'd love to see is that at some point the missions feel really co-designed across society and owned by the whole of society. They're not seen as Labour's five missions. They are seen as missions that all of us collectively feel we're contributing to and have different responsibilities towards. And of course, the public sector and the national government will have a degree of responsibility to those missions that is different from small community groups or businesses, but that there's this sense of collective national endeavour towards those missions and a sense that actually they can't be achieved by government on their own.
And so my next question then is, how far towards that are we, this sense of common ownership across society of these missions? How far are we towards that way of working?
This isn't a brand new shiny thing that is being invented by this new government. There are pockets of really good mission-driven practice that have been happening across the country and around the world. And to give one example, there's a service called Tell Us Once, and my understanding of it, in fact, I actually first came across it when I was 26, when my mum died. And I'll be honest, I wasn't a public sector nerd yet at that age, but a few days later my dad and I thought, oh god, we should probably tell someone in the government so that they stop taxing her and so on. I hadn't even thought of all the other reasons why the government would need to know, and it turns out that there is a service for that. It's called Tell Us Once, and you tell the government once and then it's links up. It tells DVLA so that her driver's license couldn't be used, HMRC for tax purposes, passport office and so on. And I've since understood, since working at the Future Governance Forum, and real credit to Public Digital, who've written about this and done lots of work on this, that Tell Us Once is a story of a handful of civil servants at the DWP thinking, this is a service that doesn't exist, but it should exist, and we know how to make it happen, so we will. And what's really crucial here is they were mid-ranking civil servants, and I don't mean that pejoratively, I mean that because good ideas don't always come from the top down. And it took them 15 years from the first idea in 2005 to finally in 2020, all councils in England, Scotland, Wales being on board. And so we're talking about really small teams working together across departments, being really persistent with something that might have been cut multiple times over in budget decisions if it had been a top-down thing. And it's, you know, it's a relatively narrow but very impressive example of mission-driven government.
That's a fantastic story and a great example. I noticed, though, that you give specific examples of individual things, but when we're talking about the overall approach, you're still couching it in the future sense. And I feel like if I'd gone back and asked you at the time of the last election where you'd like to be in 6 months, it's not exactly where we are now. And if that is the case, is it just because this is hard? Or is it that we, the public, don't understand the missions, or that the missions haven't been communicated in a way that makes us understand them? And is there more going on behind the scenes to make that happen? What I do see is a lot fewer funding pots, for example, which is great. And there's talk about single settlements for combined authorities, which is great. So there's lots, actually, I can see being done that makes this easier. But I don't think if I went out and asked in the street whether people feel a binding sense of commitment to the government's missions, I'd get many people nodding.
You're right, these things are hard, and I think the government are probably experiencing just how much is on their plate. It's very different being in opposition to being in government, and there is a real process here of civil service reform that's required. The civil service has been politically attacked for a long time now and in need of a real revitalisation. You talk about in your work a lot about the empowerment of public servants, and I think there's a kind of legacy of the difficulty of recent years. But I do think that there is, in order for the missions to feel owned by the nation, there has got to be a kind of different approach to more deliberative participatory democracy and ways in which those missions could be created in deeper partnership across society. We're seeing local authorities and combined authorities asking what the five national missions mean for them and defining them in their area with their communities. The opportunities mission is going to be very, very different in central Manchester to how it's going to be in rural Norfolk. These are kind of these have got to be locally interpreted and realised locally. Local government, combined authorities, regional government, they are going to be the delivery vehicles for achieving these missions, and so are the government, the national government are absolutely right to put them at the heart. It was great that the Prime Minister met with the mayors on, I think it was day five of his time in Downing Street.
You're absolutely right about the empowerment piece, and I talk a huge amount about how empowerment is essential to achieve innovation and achieve agility and therefore to achieve good outcomes. And organisations that centralise, I sometimes call it giganticise, where you just bring more and more together in the hope that you'll be able to push down outcomes, actually feels great if you're the person at the very centre, at the very top, because you feel like, oh, I've got all these people able to do my bidding, but actually you become the bottleneck. And as you further down the organisation you go, you get really capable people unable to progress things because they're constantly dependent on decisions from the top. You also mentioned civil service reform, and what I just described is the way the civil service is structurally designed. In many organisations, this process of pushing things up to the centre and up to the top for a decision and then waiting for it to come down, it's known to be a mistake. Most organisations have delegated authorities. They have job descriptions which push responsibilities down to people. And then when things end up being pushed up to the chief executive or to the board of directors, it's not good management practice. We can work with those people to help them empower their people. Have they got the right people? What's the thing that's stopping them? All of those questions. The civil service explicitly works on the basis of civil servants advise, ministers decide. Submissions get pushed up through the ranks to a minister who opens their red box and says yes or no. So the idea of empowering public sector workers feels really important and powerful, but it needs a complete reversal in the way the civil service has worked for centuries. Is that A, possible, and B, on the agenda?
This is about a kind of collective governance or collective accountability. And we've seen lots of goodwill with a bit of a blip in terms of the budget, but lots of goodwill from organisations outside the state as well. But actually that raises real questions. If you want to develop policy and develop strategies for achieving missions together, then actually what does that mean for shared accountability for their potential failure? And I think there has got to be a realism in those partnerships that there is only so far that political accountability can be shared, right? The buck stops with the minister. In terms of the civil service, though, this is about empowerment of public servants to do the things that they went into that job to do, to harness that passion and that motivation to change people's lives and to have a positive impact on society, rather than let that get squashed under the pressures of everything else. So I think part of that is about a culture of learning and an ability to, it's about a different type of capability that is valued in the civil service. A culture in which civil servants and politicians alike have the humility to say, I actually don't know the answer to this really complex, knotty challenge. I don't know how we're going to achieve this mission, so who do I need to work with to crack it? And that becomes a much more interesting process. That becomes a much more interesting project to be able to get out there and try and crack it in partnership with others. And we saw a bit of that type of language again in Pat McFadden's speech about announcing the Test and Learn programme. One example of that is the massive over-reliance on consultancies. I know this government have committed to reducing that reliance. It prevents a culture of learning by doing. It misses opportunities for institutional memory. And so I think it will be really interesting to see how the government approaches that over the coming months and years to build up that institutional internal capability within the civil service, which might seem like an antidote to this idea of deeper partnership working across society. But I think the two actually go really hand in hand, because it's about a longer term view of building up insight and knowledge from a much broader collection of experts and individuals.
That's a really important point. I actually do want to come back to that one. But I'm just going to pick up on, you said a blip in the goodwill around the budget. Yeah, that's not...
That's one way of putting it.
One way of putting it. But it also felt a bit like a blip in the missions, didn't it? Because, I mean, I obviously am more aware of the carbon and decarbonisation mission because of the work I do in transport and mobility. But we saw bus fare cap go up. We saw rail fares go up with inflation, and we saw fuel duty frozen, despite the fact there's a fuel duty escalator, which means that the most polluting form of transport, car travel, became cheaper proportionally to the others. So more people will drive, fewer people will use public transport, which is in direct contravention of the decarbonisation mission. And we saw employee national insurance frozen, but employer national insurance go up, which feels really hard to reconcile with the economic growth mission. So the budget's one of those big set piece moments, and it didn't really feel like it was used as a moment to sell missions. If one's being unkind, it felt like the missions were ignored in favour of pragmatic short-term decision making. Am I being unfair?
No, I think looking ahead, that's why we really need to see the spending review it was late spring, but I heard on the radio this morning it talked about in the summer, which is, you know, so anyway, late spring's probably early summer. The spending review, we really need to see that. I think that's going to be a real test moment of whether the missions approach is being taken seriously and is going to survive, because without the Treasury on board, this is really, really difficult to do. It is possible to structure a spending review or a budget around the missions. And I agree that there was a sort of missed opportunity to connect those. So it would be fantastic to see the spending review done in a more mission-driven way. I think, you know, given the timing of the election in July and the autumn budget, perhaps it's understandable that there wasn't really the time to do that whilst they're setting up the architecture around how the missions are going to be run. But I hope we'll see that in the coming months.
So let's come back to the point about consulting. And I know that Mariana Mazziazzacato, who's part of the forum, and she's done a lot of work on this, and the hollowing out of state capacity by the fact that tasks that in most organisations would be delivered by that organisation have been contracted out to consulting. And I say this as someone who is, as of the last 6 months, a consultant. But it does feel unusual the way the British state depends for core activities so heavily on the management consulting industry. We've got this thing that the British management consulting industry is one of the big success stories of Britain, but in part that's because the British government relies on it, which, as you say, means that knowledge isn't retained, etc. In practice, how do we reverse that? Because you can't just switch off capabilities that currently are relied on outside.
This isn't a black and white situation. Like, I think the value of external consultants is very clear when you've got organisation. You know, for instance, should each department be thinking about how they cut down on their water consumption, or should they, should there be experts who work in consultancies on those sorts of topics working across departments? It's not about a wholesale rejection and cancelling of partnerships with consultants. It's about demanding more of the private sector so that the public sector reaps the rewards of partnership and not just the risks. At the moment, it feels like there's an imbalance where the public sector is absorbing all of the risk and not necessarily reaping the rewards.
We've talked about missions, we've talked about consulting. What are the other future governance priorities?
So we're also particularly interested in devolution and the powers that are devolved to different levels of government. It's something that the Future Governance Forum have been real kind of advocates for and passionate about for a long time, and it's really exciting to see the changes made by the current government. So we will be following closely what happens with the white paper and steps, but I think the bottom line for us is that devolution could lead to much, much better services and experiences for people across the country. It shouldn't be seen in the technocratic public sector kind of space. It's actually about better outcomes for people and ultimately improving society in the direction that many of us would like to see.
So there's some really great stuff happening in terms of devolution at the moment. Devolution's hugely important because it's the ability for... It's the same thing as empowerment, which you spoke about earlier. It's the ability for local communities and the people closest to the decision to be actually able to make that decision, to be able to try things, to be able to innovate. All of that comes out of taking things out of central control and pushing it down to the right decision maker. One of my slight niggles about the white paper, however, is the fact that we're actually abolishing the tier of government closest to communities. From a transport point of view, that has some real advantages, which I don't want to undermine. You. We've currently hit one of the biggest obstacles to sustainable transport has been the fact that housing policy and transport policy are run by different tiers of government, which makes no sense because they're so connected, but they've been run independently of each other. Combining those, there's a lot of logic to it. I don't want to say that there's no baby with the bathwater. There's a real logic to what's being done. But if you look at the former Transport Secretary Louise Haig, she constantly talked about Dijon and the fact that Dijon has built an integrated transport network with its own light rail network, and no city the size of Dijon in Britain has done anything like that, and isn't, let's all model ourselves on Dijon. If we were the French and we were adopting the current government's devolution white paper, we'd be abolishing Dijon Council because we'd be merging it with other local authorities in adjacent areas. I'm conflicted on this. What's your view on this element of devolution?
Devolution isn't the end in itself, right? It's a goal that's rooted in improving prosperity and opportunities. And so the question that mission-driven government raises around orchestration and partnership across society raises questions about finding the sweet spot between clear central leadership and setting of direction, and therefore a degree of central control over consistency, safety, quality control, efficiencies of scale, whatever the policy area might be, versus local control and choice, alive to local conditions and local dynamics.
Final question from me. What's your level of optimism as the Future Governance Forum, but also as Grace Wilde, not as the Future Governance Forum, but personally, about fixing these issues? Because we came into 2024. I started this recording talking about HS2, which feels to me like the ultimate governance failure. And I talk about it because I'm a transport person, but actually, it's the single biggest investment this country's made, and we've ended up building a railway from somewhere that no one wants to be to somewhere no one wants to go. That, by the way, is not true. Birmingham is somewhere loads of people want to go, but it isn't Manchester and Leeds and Sheffield, and yet costing more or less the original budget with a purpose that was unclear, having already demolished a whole section of northwest London to build a station that's not yet been designed. I mean, this isn't good. We ended up in this world through the Prime Minister making a decision at a party conference in isolation without talking to any of the experts, without talking to Network Rail, without talking to the National Infrastructure Commission, without talking to HS2 themselves. This is bad. That's where we went into 2024. Coming out of 2024, how optimistic are you that we're going to be in a fundamentally different place in the future?
I share your concerns and your diagnosis. I think we're in a really, really difficult position, and I think we need a fundamentally different way of doing things. Tweaks around the edges aren't gonna get us there. I also think that, and maybe this seems like a contradiction to saying that, that there is a huge amount of expertise and will and hope across the civil service, across the political teams, across civil society, across businesses to achieve shared goals, and also to achieve goals that aren't shared. You know, there are many things that organisations across the country and local authorities across the country are focused on that aren't in the national missions, and that's also fantastic that there is a real kind of energy. I think that's where I get hope from, is that there are people doing fantastic things in communities around the country to make a change. And so the times that feel like the most hopeless are probably when I'm not really doing anything and I'm just listening to the news. But there is some really exciting stuff going on, and it is under-resourced because we aren't tapping the potential of expertise and knowledge across the country to tackle these complex problems.
Grace Wilde, thank you very much indeed for joining me on the Freewheeling podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you could join me. Thank you for listening, and thank you to Grace Wilde of the Future Governance Forum. That concludes this week's Freewheeling podcast. Do give us a rate and review on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from. Next week, we're in Birmingham, hearing about the transformation of the first city I lived in as a grown-up. Goodbye.